Oh, the first moment. This is when I fell in love with Antarctica. I was on a small ship called the John Biscoe, and we left the Falkland Islands, heading across Drake's Passage. And of course, it's pretty bumpy on Drake's Passage quite often, particularly in a small ship. And as we approached the South Orkney Islands, the sea started to calm down, and a mist formed. And us new lads thought, what the hell's going on here, you know? Out of the mist appeared this white line on the horizon, and it was pack ice, which had calmed the sea down. And then the ship started to work through the pack ice, and it's an experience which engaged all my senses. Sense of smell, the motion, the sound, the ice crunching against the side of the ship, the penguins jumping off the floats and disappearing off in all directions, the clear black water and the ice white on the surface and going green-blue as it went down into the water. It was just such a moment that I was completely sold. And I can't wait every time I go south to have that experience again.
This is Oceans, Life Underwater, a podcast series all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them. I'm Hannah Stitfall, a zoologist, wildlife filmmaker and broadcaster, and I'm on a mission to learn everything I can about the Big Blue. In this episode, we're headed south to Antarctica.
The Southern Ocean is a grand, frightening, exhilarating, strange place. It gets under your skin.
This is one of the harshest environments you can imagine. It's the windiest and coldest continent on Earth. The winds alone can get up to 200 miles per hour, and the temperatures on land can plummet to minus 80 degrees Celsius. But under the waves, it's a different story. There are more than 9,000 known species, many of which you can only find there.
My image of the Southern Ocean and Antarctica was sort of dark water or white ice and snow. But then actually when you look and just have that peak below that white blanket that's the snow and the ice, you see all these amazing colours.
This is Oceans, Life Underwater, Episode 4. I'm very lucky to be joined by John Dudeney. Now, John has been going down to the ice since the 1960s. He's an Antarctic historian and author. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome John.
Thank you, Hannah. It's really a great pleasure to be here.
Thank you for coming on today. I can't wait to talk to you. You are a wealth of all knowledge.
Well, I'm starting to forget some of it now as I get older, but yeah, I hope I am still.
So tell me what it's like to be on the Southern Ocean. I mean, does it feel dangerous? Is it rough? What can you see? What can you hear?
The Southern Ocean is a grand, frightening, exhilarating, strange place. And that's because if you look at the map, Antarctica is completely surrounded by ocean. So the seas have a chance to build up to enormous swells. They have quite a wide gap between the peaks, so it's not quite so wild as it might seem, but they can be really, really big waves. You know, you can find yourself in 10, 15 metre waves without any trouble at all. Oof. Which are quite large.
Yeah.
And if the wind's blowing at 50 or 60 knots as well, scooping the top of the waves off into spray, it can be quite exciting. So no, it's a wild place. And one of the things that I often do, been travelling on the Southern Ocean now for so many years, you stand in the wardroom, say, or in the lounge, with a gin and tonic in your hand, looking out the window and thinking, here I am, lovely, comfortable environment, gin and tonic, and just over there is death. The other side of that window is death. No two ways about it. And it's a very odd feeling. And you stop and think about all these people who've done solo yacht trips in that water. And you think, well, crikey, what are they doing?
So you'd never do a solo yacht trip?
No.
So how cold does it get down there?
That depends where you go. It's the coldest place on the planet. The lowest temperature ever recorded is about 80, minus 85 degrees C or something like that.
God.
At that temperature.
Goodness.
At that temperature, CO2 freezes. So if you take a deep breath,
That's it.
Yeah.
I can't even begin to imagine that kind of... The coldest I've ever felt was filming in northern Sweden.
Well, that would be cold.
And that was. I think it got to... It was minus 29, minus 30. And I remember stepping outside of the hide, we were filming Golden Eagles, and as we stepped out, as I breathed in and out, just all of... I got icicles start forming around there.
Yeah.
And I was saying to
I would get icicles in my beard.
Yeah, and you could feel it as you're breathing in and out.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I felt like that. And just that it's just a different sort of cold. You can feel it to your to your bones.
Yeah. Minus 40 degrees still air. You can't keep your skin warm.
Yeah. And you decided to live there.
Yeah. Oh, it was a wonderful experience. It was a life-changing experience, no doubt about it.
Talk me through that. How did you end up down there in the first place?
Well, the first place, I walked out of university in 1966, and on a whim, I joined the British Antarctic Survey. I don't know why I did it, apart from the fact that I was trying to impress the young lady at the time.
It's always the way, John.
Yeah.
Well, did it work?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it didn't. That's beside the point. And 6 months later, I was on a ship heading down Southampton Water.
Just like that?
Heading down to the Antarctic for 2 years.
Wow.
And in my second year, I was made the base commander at the age of 23, which was a shock to me, a shock to almost everybody else, I suppose, because I didn't look the part. If you saw a picture of me, though, I couldn't even grow a beard. So So I found myself running an Antarctic station through an Antarctic winter. But I was both the base commander, the government magistrate, the postmaster, the doctor and the dentist.
The doctor and the dentist?
Yep.
I mean, did you have any pre-training of being a doctor or a dentist?
No. There were several events that got in the way of their normal operation. So when I got somebody who was really very ill in the middle of winter, I had to deal with it by radio. This guy developed what's known as ulcerative colitis. We didn't have the drugs to deal with it. We were completely isolated from the outside world. And so a rather long and complicated rescue attempt started. What I believe to be, if not the first, probably nearly the first, winter flight into the Antarctic to drop drugs to us.
Goodness.
And then we tried to use an aircraft from another station to fly the guy further, as far north as we could get, to take him off with an icebreaker. But unfortunately, that plane crashed as well.
Oh, my goodness.
No, it was quite a story. I was in the plane that we flew into an iceberg trying to...
You were in the plane?
Yeah.
When it flew into an iceberg?
Yes. Yeah, we got airborne. We were taking off on a short ice runway, about 500 metres of sea ice, and then there was open water and broken sea ice. And the engine iced up, so we lost power. Of course, if we went straight ahead, we'd have been into icy water, air temperature of about minus 15, we would have been gone.
Done.
So the pilot tried to bank, and out of the mist loomed this iceberg, which was higher than we were, but it had a valley in it, and he got the plane in the valley. So one wing scraped,
this wing scraped
across the valley and folded, so it ceased to be a wing. And we came over the other side, where there was some fresh sea ice had formed, and we crashed down on that. One ski went through, we ended up resting on the broken wing and the other ski and spinning. So we came to a, we skidded along and we came to a stop. The door burst open next to me, and I saw an ice foot. That's a place where the sea ice joins the land ice. I thought, I'm off. And the next thing I remember, I was still on the ice foot looking back at the aeroplane. And then, of course, once I got out and realised what was going on and the fact that we were actually on a small island, not on an iceberg, we started to get the sick guy out of the plane and so on and so forth and get ourselves sorted out. But we hit a few things.
There's not many people that can say they flew into an iceberg.
Well, not and lived, no. No, it was an odd experience because, you know, by then I was very experienced about what was possible and wasn't possible in the Antarctic. I didn't have a seatbelt because there weren't any, so I was being thrown around in the back of the plane. Every time we hit something, I got chucked about somewhere. And I can remember thinking to myself, the next time I hit that bulkhead, that's it. You know? And luckily it wasn't.
Goodness me. And now you're sat here all these years later.
Yep.
Telling the tale.
Yep. But I had to learn to fly to get over fear of flying as a result of that. So I went and learned to fly.
And that must have just added, you know, that was your first time down there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, of course, when you first arrived, the feelings of, you know, that isolation, and you must have been like, oh, goodness me, I don't really know what I'm doing here. Being so isolated from the rest of the world. And then, of course, all of that happening.
Yeah.
What made you keep going back, to be honest? I would have been like, do you know what? I'm going home.
It gets under your skin. It just takes over. It's a place of such grandeur, such majesty, such interest. I've had a career where I can really say I didn't have a job for a living. I did what I wanted to do. I mean, I frightened myself several times, including flying into icebergs and other things. but it's just been a wonderful time, and I'm tremendously grateful for it. I've done some really interesting science. I've seen all sorts of things going on in Antarctica. I've been involved in the politics of Antarctica. So, no, it's been great.
And what would you say has been, I'm sure you've had many memorable moments. What is one of your most memorable moments with a wildlife species down there?
Cor, goodness me. I suppose it's in the springtime, going out on the sea ice and watching Weddell seals pup.
Oh, wow.
And then the pup just sitting on the ice for the first 2 weeks, just ballooning out with this really rich milk before it's pushed down a breathing hole and taught how to swim.
Wow.
But also another one would be walking out on the sea ice in the winter on a calm day and listening to the sound of silence, because you have silence there like you have nowhere else. And if there's a seal under the sea ice, you'll hear it. You'll hear it calling. If there's an avalanche 20 miles away in the mountains, you'll hear it. But otherwise, you've got this absolute silence. If the wind gets up, then you start to hear the whistling of the spindrift on the surface. It's just magic.
And how often now do you go? Because I know you're very busy. We were talking before, you've got 3 books on the go at the moment. You know, busy, busy man, John.
Well, normally I try to go down these days as a tour guide once a year. For this year, I haven't been able to go, but I hope I'll get back to it. But I'm getting a bit old now. So I'm pushing 79. So.
No, you've still got a few more experiences flying into icebergs, I can tell.
Well, I'd prefer not to fly into icebergs. That's not really very habit for me. Well, sadly, the amount of sea ice is disappearing quite quickly at the moment, and that has significant ecological consequences, particularly for krill, because krill, which is the main feedstock for the whales, of course, at least the baleen whales, they're young, basically have nurseries underneath the marginal pack ice, and they live off the phytoplankton in the ice. As the ice retreats, so then the krill are going to be impacted. Mm. And that means the whole of the ecosystem of South Georgia is impacted, because the krill aren't born there. They're born on the Antarctic Peninsula, and they're carried by the west wind drift, the current of the ocean, to South Georgia, where they provide the feedstock for all the wildlife.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading, actually, that krill distribution has actually moved 200 miles from where it originally was. I know it moves across the ocean, but it's where they're breeding, it is starting.
Well, that's because of the retreat of the sea ice.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first went down the Antarctic Peninsula in 1966, in December, we spent a lot of time bashing our way through pack ice. Now that's very unlikely to happen. Very unlikely you'll see any pack ice. And now, when you go down to the northern end of the Antarctic Peninsula, it doesn't snow in the summer, it rains.
Really?
That was something that would have been very unusual in my time, first of all. And of course, that has a feedback, because the rain onto snow melts the ice, changes the albedo, makes everything speed up.
So in the time that you've been going down there in your lifetime, you've seen a huge change.
Yeah, and some of the changes are quite surprising. One of them is the resurgence of Gentoo penguins. Mm. When I wintered, We had an island nearby us that had a penguin rookery on it. They were entirely adelies. And around our station, even in the summer, we would have mostly snow and ice, not rock. Now when I go back there, the station is completely surrounded by rock, and there are Gentoo penguins nesting outside the station. And that's because the Gentoos need rock for their nesting. So they're progressing southwards, pushing the adelie penguins southwards. So there's quite an ecological change taking place at the moment as more rock becomes more available for the Gentoos to nest. So the Gentoos are doing quite well.
But as we see across ecosystems throughout the world, there will be winners and losers.
Oh, absolutely.
And the
Gentoos appear to be winners at the moment. But other things are happening now. There's an Antarctic grass, which normally would be only at the most northern ends of the Antarctic Peninsula. That's spreading southwards.
Mm.
So, you know, things are changing, and there's much more rock exposed than there ever was before. And you can see that the rock has not been exposed for many, many years because it's completely clean. It has no vegetation, no lichen or moss or anything on it. My favourite fact about the Southern Ocean is being off the northern coast of Elephant Island, surrounded by fin whales. So many blows at once, it was just like the air was full of fog. And that is wonderful because it shows the return of the species. And the reason they're all there is because there's an upwelling as you bump into the island, bringing nutrients to the surface, and they're all there feeding. And it was a sight that was just incredible because there were so many of them. And they're all happily getting on with their lives again.
Because I live down in Cornwall,
yeah.
And the amount of humpbacks we're now seeing around the coastline and fin whales.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, oh, well, why are they here? And it's because populations are
Well, the
recovering.
Fin whales and the humpbacks are doing very well.
Yeah.
Blue whales, not so well.
Mm.
But I saw my first blue whale about 4 years ago off South Georgia, off Saunders Island, Cooper Island, rather. And last year I saw a blue whale with a calf quite close to the ship. There's a small pod of them now developing on the southern end of South Georgia. When you see a blue whale, you know you've seen a blue whale. There's no doubt about that. It can't be anything else. It's just so bloody big.
Yeah. Well, thank you, John. That was fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much. I'm going to have to get down to Antarctica.
You really should go and go soon and go on a small ship.
Okay.
Go on a ship that's carrying 100 passengers and no more.
Okay.
Because you'll have the most incredible experience if you do.
When are you going? I want to come with you.
I don't know yet, but it'll be sometime next season.
All right, let me know. Thank you.
Thank you.
A quick little message from me. If you're enjoying this series, and I really hope that you are, help us out by hitting the follow button. We'd also love to see you on TikTok, Instagram, and X/Twitter. You can watch videos of what life in Antarctica looks like and enjoy extra bonus content. At Oceans Pod, spread the word. The whole Antarctic continent has more than 11,000 miles of coastline. That's basically the same distance from the North Pole to the South Pole. That is a lot of ocean. But what does it look like underwater? My second guest today is Lucy Woodall. Lucy is a marine biologist who's led many expeditions to the Southern Ocean. She does a lot of work in trying to open up the ocean space and make it more accessible for people across the globe. So welcome, Lucy. Thank you for coming along today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Now, I'm going to go straight in with the first question. What does the Southern Ocean look like underwater?
You know what, that's a great question. And when I first went down, I didn't have a clue, right? Because my image of the Southern Ocean and Antarctica was sort of dark water or white ice and snow. But then actually when you look and just have that peak below that white blanket that's the snow and the ice, you see all these amazing colours. Because of course the organisms that live down in the ocean, they don't know it's snowing up top, right? So it's the same colours, the brightness, the intensity, the diversity of shapes and sizes and colour that we see down at depth.
And how quickly does that become apparent? So when you get into dive, is there a bit of murkiness? And at what level underneath does the colour really spring to life?
So the work that I've done is with remotely operated vehicles. So we haven't kind of started near shore. We've started like right out in the ocean and we've gone to maybe like 200 metres. There's often a little bit of a layer on the surface of the water where there's maybe some fresh water that's not mixing super well with the salty water. So it almost looks like there's a bit of murkiness. But then once you get out of that layer, which is the top few meters, you get this absolutely crystal clear. We had the most amazing visibility. For me, going down and having quite an uncertain situation on deck, you know, not quite knowing where the ice flows are going to go, when we're going to have to pull the ROV up and leave our site. So, you know, lots of decisions being made. And then coming down, descending sort of from the light into the darkness, and then seeing those bright colours and just the calming effect that that has on me, I find that really powerful. And it makes me feel very small. And I think that's actually a really important feeling when we're into these spaces. You know, we are just a tiny snapshot in the world's history.
And what sort of species do you see down there?
For me, the most surprising thing in Antarctica was seeing coral. You think of coral and you think of Nemo fish. Right? You think of yeah. beautiful sandy beaches.
The tropics.
The tropics, your summer holidays. But in fact, there are a number of corals that we call cold water corals that live at depth and live in Antarctica. We also see sponges, just like the loofahs in your bathroom. Imagine them sticking out the seabed. And I think my favourite is something called a sea pig. Shall I describe to you what a sea pig looks like?
I would love you to, Lucy.
Okay. So think of your kitchen fridge, so it'll get you cold, right? And in your fridge, you've got your pot of gherkins, okay? Pick out a gherkin. Now turn it pink in your mind. Pink, small pink gherkin.
Small pink gherkin, okay.
And then...
we go in there.
And then the final step, hopefully you'll like this, is put a hat on it that is full of feathers about two-thirds of the way down. And that is what your sea pig looks like.
So I've got a small pink gherkin with a feathery hat on, yeah?
Sweet. You got it.
That's dreams right there, yeah? That's dreams. And are they only found in Antarctica?
You get sea pigs all around the world, but the ones that we saw when we were down in Antarctica most frequently were these beautiful pink sea pigs. And they're just the thing that comes to mind when anybody asks me any questions about the seabed in Antarctica. All I can think about is the little pink gherkins with the feathery hats.
I need to see a photograph of one of these now. I really do. So you throw me with the pink gherkins, small ones. I was going to ask you, what's the most amazing things you've seen underwater there? apart from the pink gherkins with the feathery hats.
I think I was quite surprised when I was first looking in the deep sea, just how many organisms kind of relied on each other for their habitat. So we can think about the seabed being some corals and some sponges, and they live on hard substrate, just like rock, right? Because they've got to attach to something. But having that coral and that sponge in that one location means that we get all sorts of other things, like little lobsters, little crabs, snails, brittle stars and basket stars, just like the starfish that we see off our coastlines. Brittle stars, like you would imagine, having very tiny little legs, and basket stars almost thinking like they could encompass the entirety of your head. It's okay, they don't. And these things together are filter feeders. So they're feeding off that really richly nutritious cold water that is sinking, that what we call Antarctic bottom water, that is sinking, creating the wonderful 3D conveyor belt that goes across our one ocean, across the planet, providing nutrients for even us here in the UK.
Tell us about some species that can only be found in the Southern Ocean, nowhere else.
Yeah, so species that live in Antarctica are really varied. And I'm just going to give two examples here. So one is that above the ocean. And when we think of that, we think of a lot of our penguin species. We saw lots of Adélie penguins. They're incredibly inquisitive. They don't see humans, really, because they live on these big floating ice islands, these ice floes. So Adélies, I think, were probably the first thing I saw when I was down in Antarctica. So I always like to think of them as kind of my penguin. I'm sure they don't remember me, so I'm probably not their human. But
what,
anyway,
what did you feel like when you first saw, you were in Antarctica and you see your first Adélie penguin?
I didn't quite believe it. Their ability to move, their ability to be able to leap out of the water. I mean, vast distances. And then you really were able to appreciate their environment. It wasn't just air breathing. Their environment's very different to ours. It's this massive 3D space that includes the ocean.
So you said at the top of that, two species that are found in the... What's the second one?
So I want to introduce to you the Patagonian toothfish. So Patagonian toothfish are very long-lived fish, quite important for fisheries. But it's something that we as humans have exploited over time. Now, the thing about Patagonian toothfish and other large fish in these areas is because they're long-lived, they can take a long time to mature, so we have to be incredibly careful how we can sustainably manage them for future generations. Only by really understanding things which might seem very remote to us sitting here in London, why would I want to know about a random fish in the middle of the Southern Ocean? Actually, it does make a difference because those fish, just like the funny little penguins, have their role in their ecosystem. And only by ensuring we have that diverse ecosystem down in Antarctica can we actually live our lives here in London as we expect.
So how long do they live for?
Yeah, so Patagonian toothfish, you know, can live up to 50 to 60 years that we know, right? And I would always caveat that because we know as humans we can live different ages. Across the planet, there's different survival rates for all of us as well. So there's still a lot more information for us to really understand about different stocks, where they're living, and how that is changing with climate that is changing across the planet.
100%. And now we know that krill underpins the entire Antarctic ecosystem. And I've got actually written here, it's estimated that 700 trillion adult Antarctic krill are in the Southern Ocean. Mm-hmm. And their swarms can be seen from space. That's incredible. Mm. But for our listeners, why are they so important? Mm.
Yeah, so krill is what we would call a keystone species, right? The penguins we spoke about earlier, they're going to be feeding on the krill, they're going to be feeding on things that feed on the krill. And what krill do is have this critical point in the middle here, so they're not just fully predators, like some of our big fish and our penguins up at the top, and they're not the little tiny plants, the little algae that live in the summer months in Antarctica. They're this point in the middle, so they really control the whole system, being able to funnel energy from the sun and from the nutrient-rich waters all the way through to some of those higher-end predators and some of our really large mammals as well, lots of our whales and such like.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading about it, and crab-eating seals, they've got specially adapted teeth because they eat a lot of krill. Leopard seals eat a lot of krill, so we automatically think, you know, krill, whales, but it's everything that takes huge advantage of krill as a keystone species. It's really, really important.
Yes.
Tell me about your trip to find a particularly mysterious sunken ship.
Yeah, so They did find it after we'd left on another expedition. But I was really lucky to be part of the biology team that was on an expedition to go look for Shackleton ship, the Endurance, down in the Weddell Sea. I mean, it's a shame on our expedition we didn't. Obviously, we didn't see it. It would have been amazing if we did. It's so exciting that subsequently a team has been able to locate it and take images. And I think from those images, you can really see what life lives down in the deep sea. I don't know if you've seen some of the images of the wheel that is still on the ship, and you can see some sea stars around that wheel. So it's quite nice. You know, you've got a biological wheel and you've got a human-made wheel. So I quite like that analogy.
And I suppose as well with what you do, you're going into worlds that new discoveries can be made all the time because we still don't really know what's down there, which is really exciting, especially for a scientist, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. When we head down into the deep sea, we're very, very often the first humans ever to see that bit of our planet.
Wow. That's pretty special.
It really is when we think about the number of people who climb up our tallest mountains every year. But, you know, the far, far fewer have ever gone down into the deepest trenches and certainly not gone down and been able to view them. Being able to look at that bit of the planet is important. I think it's completely altered me as a human. You know, I grew up by the sea. The sea is part of who I am. But having that experience was really fundamental to how I think. And also noticing that bit of the ocean has been impacted by humans. So we've not seen it before, but actually we've had consequences at those depths, whether that be due to climate change or types of pollution. And those two plots together, I think, is incredibly powerful.
I mean, when you think about it, I was reading the other week, the US government is investing $100 million to, you know, find intelligent life elsewhere, like, you know, in space. Yeah. We've got so much here already that we don't even know what's there. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe we should put our efforts into finding what's down below rather than up above first. But that's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, of course, in the deep sea, we've used lots of technologies that have started off, you know, in some of those space programs. So we've definitely benefited from that. I feel that sometimes we as humans try and sort of curate our environments, you know, even thinking about things like having heating, right? We curate our environments to make them more comfortable for ourselves. And the more we do that, the more remote we get from our natural environments. So even if you never go down to the sea, you never see salt water in your life, that ocean has really important impacts on how we live our lives. You know, I often talk to school kids and they're like, oh yeah, rainforests are really important. But they won't necessarily know that the ocean is important. How do we do that? How do we lift our blue blanket from our 2D place that we spend a week in the summer on holidays, make sandcastles and go for a paddle, into something that we feel kind of more connected to, right? Because if we feel connected to it, we want to do something about it. And we want to both understand it and make sure that it is there for future generations in a state that is going to allow them to do what they need to do.
Well, Lucy, I mean, you've captured me with the mini pink gherkin with the feathery hat. I mean, that's, I want the Southern Ocean to be all right now, and I'm going to go and look them up. I can't wait. But thank you for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
No problem. It's been wonderful chatting with you and sharing that image.
Next week. Did you know the longest mountain range in the world is underwater? I'm asking all the questions you ever wanted to know about mountains under the waves. And if you can't wait until then, stick around for our closing story. Today we're meeting someone who takes their love for the ocean to new limits.
My name is Bhakti Sharma. I'm from India. Among many things, I am an open water swimmer, so I held the world record of swimming the longest distance in the Antarctic Ocean, being the first Asian and youngest swimmer in the world to swim in all five oceans of the world. I still struggle to put that experience in words just because it was so much. All the training in the world does not prepare you for that moment when you see your first iceberg. The swim itself was amazing. I trained enough so that I didn't hyperventilate when I jumped into the water, but the thing that struck me the most was how salty it was and how dense it was, because I felt like I was pulling through oil. That's how dense the water was. And I didn't expect it to be this dark grayish black color. You couldn't see too much past the first two layers of the ocean. And it was just scary in the beginning because it's intimidating. The beauty is intimidating. And I had the thoughts of giving up, you know, I was questioning my entire life choice. And then I saw a penguin swim underneath my stomach. It was swimming underneath me, and then it came to my left hand side and it started swimming with me. And I guess it was just curious that this is this big creature, but it's not trying to eat me. And so it started swimming with me, and I took the penguin as my personal cheerleader, and I just focused on it for the next 10-15 minutes, and it kept me going. That's when I learned that the ocean is going to be a space for me where I express all my emotions. I express who I am freely. You know, I've cried in the ocean. I've screamed and yelled in the ocean. It's taught me a lot of things. You know, it's taught me resilience. It's taught me how to be with myself, which is the biggest one. In India, it's a very weird dichotomy because we worship everything in nature, especially in the Hindu culture, but we don't have that personal connection with the oceans as I see in the West. You'll not see a lot of people stepping into the water body on a beach, but I wish that people would connect more with our water bodies, would connect more to the oceans. It still holds that sense of mystery and intimidation for people. My name is Bhakti Sharma, and I am a student of the ocean.
This episode was brought to you by Greenpeace and Crowd Network. It's hosted by me, wildlife filmmaker and broadcaster Hannah Stitful. It's produced by Anna Stauffenberg, and our executive producer is Steve Jones. Editing and sound design by Anna Stauffenberg. The music we use is from our partners, BMG Production Music. Archive courtesy of Greenpeace. The team at Crowd Network is Catalina Nogueira, Archie Biltcliffe, George Sampson, and Robert Wallace. The team at Greenpeace is James Hansen, Flora Havesi, Alex Yallop, Janae Mayer, and Alice Lloyd Hunter. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next week.